TFM.
This is J.G. Hertzler, General Mar Talker on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine show. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he always is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. And Matthew, I don't know why Starfleet has sent us another co-host. Did you see this guy over here? I mean, you're in charge of co-hosting The Orb. Who does this Michael Eddington guy think he is?
Apparently he's sent here as support. I don't know, maybe Starfleet doesn't really like the job that I'm doing. You know, I do like to kind of do things on my own terms, and reports just aren't my thing.
That's one way of describing it. Others might say you like thumbing your nose at authority.
It's possible. It's possible. I mean, I don't know who would say that. I might have to track them down.
Someone on Twitter, probably.
Probably.
Yes, everyone. Today, we're going to be doing one of our character discussions, and we're going to talk about Michael Eddington. I think instead of having him actually co-host, we'll just keep him over in the corner. We'll just talk about him. It's kind of rude to do
plan.
It while he's in the room, but, you know, Odo taught us not to care about that kind of thing.
This is true.
Okay. So, Matthew, we all know Odo is in charge of security on the station, but here comes Michael Eddington. He shows up on the station at the beginning of season 3 in The Search. And given the various changes that are happening at the beginning of season 3, the Defiant coming, Dax's hair changing, revelations about the Dominion, you have to think, is this Eddington guy going to be the new security officer on the station? Is Odo going to be pushed off in some other direction? What did you think about the addition?
Yeah, I always thought this was a really interesting choice for them, and partly because it does create the conundrum for Odo. And I think what it really helps do is make The Search a much more difficult episode for Odo in the first place, because then he finds his people, and then he realizes he kind of has to reject his people because of who they are against the people that he's basically grown up with. And yet there is this quote-unquote elephant in the room with Eddington, who is there because Odo doesn't like to play by the Starfleet rules. And he is so used to being able to do things his own way. And it's, you know, never been a problem for Sisko. Sisko trusts him. He's earned his trust. But when it comes to the bureaucracy of Starfleet, you know, Eddington is the person that's going to be there. And I think the most interesting thing to me about the introduction with Eddington is how you want to dislike the guy, but, you know, I mean, he even tells everybody, hey, I'm here to make friends, you know? And so I think that's what makes that really interesting, is that we start off with him as a character that it's kind of hard to hate because he doesn't really do anything to make you hate him at the beginning other than just being there.
Well, he does have this sort of arrogant attitude. Maybe that's how to describe it. There's something about him that, I don't know, made me feel uneasy about him from the beginning. If I were there, maybe, I don't know, maybe it was Tarul being next to him. Maybe she threw me off.
Well, it could be. I mean, having the Romulan there for what was it, two episodes, was a little bit interesting.
Yeah. But I guess it's maybe, you know, he says he's there to make friends. He's laying it on kind of thick, trying to be nice to everybody. But given all my years of experience being around people, especially in a business setting, which is ultimately what this is on the station, there's a disingenuous nature to him that I feel and makes me a little bit suspicious of him. Does that seem odd for me to have that feeling from the start?
No, I mean, I think that's the thing about, you know, as I was thinking back over this character and his arc, they do a really good job of waffling you as an audience member between can he be trusted or can he not be trusted? Because, you know, he kind of earns his spot. And then, you know, when the die is cast, he's willing to follow Starfleet commands over Sisko's, which is, you know, he wrecks the cloaking device in that episode. And so I find that really interesting because they do this thing where they kind of make you kind of trust him for a while, and then they do something that kind of makes you not trust him, and then you start trusting him again, and it just kind of gets back and forth with him. And, you know, of course, then he joins the Maquis and really, you know, puts you over on a completely different side, which is a really interesting thing. Yeah. So I don't think you're wrong in the sense that you're never quite sure what to think of him until he really makes that decision. And then you realize, okay, well, no, we're not necessarily supposed to trust this person.
Right, right. So it's interesting, yeah, that they did make us have that uneasy feeling about him. And as you said, waffling, we're not really sure. So when we get to the adversary and the changeling tries to frame him by making it look like it's his blood is actually the material, just before we then find out, no, actually they've locked Bashir in. After that was made clear that Eddington is not a changeling, lots of fans at the time really thought Eddington is a changeling, that they were convinced, even beyond that, that Eddington was a changeling. And I guess that one reason for that, because it might seem kind of odd that the writers are showing you pretty clearly that Eddington is not a changeling, but people still thought that. And the fact that they did such a good job of making you uncertain about his motives and who he is leading up to this, and also that Kenneth Marshall did such a good job of playing that on screen, probably explains why that sentiment continued even after you're being told, no, that's not what's happening.
Well, and I think the beauty of the performance, too, is that, like you said, you're never quite sure what to think of him. And then he makes that turn and just becomes so self-righteous. And in all of it, he plays it really, really well. So I love the fact that you really do have this character who's brought in there to challenge Odo. But what I find most interesting is that, you know, Odo has to make that choice between the Dominion and, you know, the people that he grew up with, basically. Mm-hmm. And then you have Eddington, who kind of has to make the same choice. It's, do I choose the Maquis or do I choose, you know, Starfleet? And he chooses differently than Odo did. Although, you know, Odo will have his dalliance later on, but yeah. He still comes back. But with Eddington, it is this, you know, Eddington says that he got into Starfleet because he always wanted to be in command. He wanted to be a captain. Yeah. You know, he wanted the power. I think he wanted people to look up to him. He wanted to be basically the hero. And that kind of rebellious streak, or I guess almost like selfish streak, the kind of
like because he wants the attention.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Thank you. And so that's what I find really, really interesting about him, because he's kind of undone by his own character. Mm-hmm. Like, and I mean internal character, like the person that he is. And he makes excuses, I think, for the choices that he makes by trying to pretend that there isn't another choice, as if, you know, that like he's the Maquis are being put upon. So,
yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. I want to talk about the Maquis a little bit more and that shift. Before that, though, let's talk about the development of the character from like the original intention of bringing him on the show to where he ended up, because you pointed out that he was meant to be an adversary of sorts for Odo. Maybe like a mild adversary, just a little bit of conflict for Odo in the security arena, Starfleet versus non-Starfleet. And there is that line where Sisko tells Odo, this is not a racial issue. And I found that interesting because I think that the way that racial issues are addressed on television today and in Star Trek and in writing and all are a lot more... I don't know if nuanced is the right word. I think like the complexity of racial issues and the dialogue around it has become greater in the years since DS9 was written. And this comment in the episode In Search from Sisko, I think just highlights how Star Trek, even at that time, was making an effort in their own way to address the idea of someone being distrusted because of their race. And it makes sense with what they're doing with Odo here because of the changelings and the fact that there's this growing fear between the Federation and the Dominion and how the Federation views the changelings because they don't know that much about them yet. So that's one thing with him being there as a sort of a conflict for Odo. And as you pointed out earlier, making the events of The Search much more difficult for Odo, because not only is he coming into contact with his own people, but it's happening at the same time that his existence on the station is being stirred up by the arrival of this new person and apparent distrust from the Federation. But the other thing about Eddington is that he was brought on the show because we all know that Colmini often would leave to go do films and wasn't always available to shoot DS9. And so they had this idea of bringing on a somewhat similar character, like the everyday Joe, onto the show. Mm-hmm. Because O'Brien is like that. You know, he's like the everyday Joe. He's the chief. He's the handyman. His character evolves a lot, but at its core, he's the guy that just knows how stuff works kind of instinctively, mm-hmm. I would say, and keeps the station running. You know, he's that everyday guy. And so they wanted someone else like that, and they brought Eddington in for that purpose as well. But I'm not so sure that that really worked the way they expected and might be part of the reason why they ended up going in another direction with the character. What do you think about those aspects of it?
Yeah, I mean, in the end, I don't think that it obviously doesn't work the way they want it to, because, you know, one, they put him in security. And so, I mean, he's never going to really be able to fill that role. And I think the way they write him, or the way he's played, the personality is just not the same as O'Brien, who this, you know, everyday guy. Whereas Eddington always kind of feels a little bit like somebody who has a chip on his shoulder.
Yeah, exactly.
And I just don't think that part fits, you know. I mean, gosh, literally O'Brien is the guy you go get a beer with, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And Eddington is just somebody you could tell is trying to climb the Starfleet ladder. Mm-hmm. But
realizes that he can't. And maybe that's part of why he has this chip on his shoulder, because you mentioned earlier that, you know, he wants the attention. He wants to be the hero. I think he wants to be the leader. And in this organization, he's realized that he's not going to climb up that ladder. That might affect that feeling that, like, he has a chip on his shoulder, like you said.
Yeah, I think what would be interesting is to get more of his history in the sense of, like, you know, was he brought to Deep Space Nine because maybe it was almost a punishment or something, and, you know, he's somebody who just hasn't quite been able to fit in other places. And, I mean, again, he's somebody whose desire is to be a captain.
Yeah. I don't think that that's what happened, because the background that we do know about the character, the idea, I don't think this is ever said on screen. This is just some of the writer's background of it. He was supposed to be like the best security officer in Starfleet. He's among the very best Starfleet has to offer. So I don't think that they would have sent him to DS9 as sort of a punishment because he was a misfit or couldn't get along with people, but rather because they thought this is the one guy that's going to be able to clean up this Odo situation and secure the station.
Well, I mean, it's he's clearly somebody that Starfleet feels like they can trust, which is exactly what
makes me wonder about Starfleet.
Yeah.
Because of the feeling that we get when we watch him.
Mm-hmm. Yes. But I mean, he is somebody who sabotages the Defiant and the cloaking device at their request, right?
Right.
And so he is somebody that they can trust, at least for a while.
Yeah.
And, you know, I do think I wish that there was a little bit more depth to the character in their turn towards the Maquis. I think I would have liked just a little bit more on that to really understand why it is that he's making this turn.
Yeah.
But I do think it's the hero complex that he has.
Yeah.
And that definitely plays out as we, you know, watch him make that turn.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. So when we head into season four, going back to the idea that he's there to create a bit of conflict with Odo on the security front. In season four, we see him shift more towards what O'Brien is doing, where he gets some engineering duties. We see him assist with the Trill in Rejoined. We see him moving away from that security aspect. And I think it's probably because Worf came onto the show, and we have that security mentality conflict between Worf and Odo, which plays out quite a bit in the beginning of season four, where Worf in particular can't quite adjust to the idea that he's not there to head up security.
Yeah, and I think in many ways that's, to me, it seems like that's why they kind of put him off on this other trajectory.
Mm-hmm.
Because they just don't need him for that story.
And when they created him and brought him in, they didn't know at that time that they were going to be bringing Worf on. So it's a unexpected course correction they had to make.
Yep, exactly. And so I think and what I love is that they didn't just throw the character away.
Mm-hmm.
They use him then really ultimately as a foil for Sisko. And this whole idea of, you know, what does it mean to do the right thing? And what is the right thing? And so, I think that's the thing that's so fascinating to me, is that they do set up the Maquis and his role in it as this group that feels as though they've been done wrong by the greater powers, right?
Yeah. Right.
And yet, it seems to me as though what they're fighting for is to continue a fight. And it's more than likely to get two major powers into a war again, instead of, like, what they care about is themselves and not the whole.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's always the struggle that I've had with, like, identifying with the Maquis in any way, is just because I feel like what they want is ultimately selfish, because they're willing basically to start another war between two major powers to get what they want. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing that really kind of, like, bothers me, which, you know, it makes them different than say the Bajorans, who become terrorists to try and get the Cardassian off their own planet.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. The Bajoran situation is quite different because it is them fighting for their home world, one planet, the planet on which they evolved. You know, the Maquis are colonists who have settled on various planets in this demilitarized zone. And, you know, it's easy for us, for people, when we don't have to move from a place we consider home, it's easy for us to say to someone, you could just move to a safer place. But if you were actually in that situation, I think it would be a difficult decision to make, and maybe you wouldn't want to move. So I get that. But like you're saying, I think that the approach that they're taking seems to be one of stirring up more conflict rather than trying to resolve conflict.
Yeah.
I also feel like the Maquis, well, there are several things about the Maquis. One is that they were created to establish the premise of Voyager, so that you have this Maquis Starfleet combination where these two sides who have different views of the Federation ideals have to work together. But DS9 is actually the show that does the most with the Maquis. And it also, it feels to me like the premise of the Maquis, because it turns up in season two, was developed at a time before they knew they were going to have the Dominion as the big adversary, and that the Dominion War would create conflict on the show. And so here's a way to create conflict in a show that was quite stationary in the beginning, add excitement to the show. And it is interesting to have that conflict be internal to the Federation, where you have a group of Federation citizens who are pushing back against what most people would see, at least in that universe, as paradise, which is a point that Eddington makes to Sisko. But the thing about the Maquis themselves, I can get my mind around who they are, why they're doing the thing that they're doing. But Eddington's shift to the Maquis has always felt a little bit odd to me, because he doesn't offer what I consider to be a clear and sufficient explanation for why he makes the move. You know, he talks to Sisko about how the Federation just can't handle the fact that there are these people who want to leave it, who don't want to be part of it. Like that is enough justification. But I guess as we're talking about it today, the points about him wanting to be the center of something, him wanting attention, makes sense in that he finds a cause where people place him in a position of leadership in a way that Starfleet hasn't and isn't going to do. He cannot reach that level that he wants to reach. And I think maybe the seed of all of that is the moment when Sisko is elevated to captain, because they have that exchange in that ceremony. And that's when we find out that Eddington really is obsessed with rank and that he wanted to be a captain. And because it's face-to-face with Sisko, I think Eddington sees Sisko in that moment as having reached the point that he himself wants to reach but can't. And so that creates a moment of conflict in Eddington's mind anyway, between him and Sisko, that just kind of evolves and spins out of control over the course of a couple of seasons.
Well, and what it creates in him is this idea of a victim complex, right? Because he casts himself in the literary role of Jean Valjean.
Yeah.
And, you know, Sisko is Javert. Yeah. And that's not Sisko at all. Because Sisko is somebody who's willing to bend the rules. What it becomes is this thing where Sisko feels his honor betrayed for having trusted somebody and not being able to see that they were a traitor.
Yeah.
And to traitor to everything that Sisko does believe in. And it's not even this sense of, you know, like that Sisko himself is the letter of the law type of guy. So again, I think we have a real insight into Eddington's psyche, which is that he aggrandizes himself quite a lot. you know, yeah. And therefore it creates this conflict. And in that, and in some ways, it's almost like that's why I think he gets involved with the Maquis, because they become this David versus a quote unquote Goliath. And like they talk about the you know, people that want to leave the Federation, but it's like there are other places to go other than the demilitarized zone, which is basically a neutral zone between Cardassia and the Federation. Mm-hmm. If you really just wanted to leave the Federation, there's plenty of other places to colonize other than there, right. You know? Yeah. And again, to be so hell-bent on being in one place, even though your being there could cause another interstellar war, really just shows kind of the selfishness of the whole situation. Yeah. So it's really interesting. So
yeah. Although if you look at Earth, I do these things often in our discussions. If you look at Earth today, in the past, probably in the future, it is very common for a group of people, a society, a country, areas in a country, to be so concerned about what's happening to the Omano local level that they don't mind the fact that they may be creating a much, much wider conflict. And I'm not talking about anybody specific mm-hmm. here. So this is not a commentary on any particular situation. It's just a general human nature that this happens, that we think about right. ourselves locally so much that it's common to turn a blind eye either through ignorance or just because we're not interested in what happens mm-hmm. on a wider scale. But our actions may have repercussions on a wide scale. And that's what happens with the Maquis here.
Right.
So it's easy for me to see that on whatever planet a particular group of Maquis are living, they feel at home there and they don't want to move and they don't really care what they stir up around them as long as they can just stay there. About him putting himself in the role of Jean Valjean, you know, it's, I think initially, well, I think that what he wants to do is put himself in his favorite book, which is Les Miserables, and he wants to just play out the story with himself at the center of it. And again, we see sometimes people in real life think that way and do something like that. Like the first moments of the connection between him as Jean Valjean and Sisko as Javert don't quite mesh. But once you really get into the story and you get into the revolution aspects of it, I think that like Valjean, he wants to be swept up in this revolution, which is the Maquis trying to push back against the Federation. And from that point on, he's so caught up in it that he just, yeah, he casts Sisko in the role of Javert and then lets it all mm-hmm. play out from there. So Les Miserables is my favorite musical, my favorite Broadway musical. And so I love the fact that the writer has actually incorporated that into a Deep Space Nine story. But if I look at it from a purely, like if I were in that universe and I'm looking at these two human beings and what they're doing, I think that Eddington is going a bit far in his love for the book.
Well, and again, I mean, his reading of the situation is so wrong. You know, I mean, to put yourself in that role doesn't really make any sense, because what's happening here is not the same type of situation. Mm-hmm. And so it's a very, very surface reading, obviously, of the story in the first place. So, I think there's so much more happening here. And I think one of the things I kind of love is the depth of that, because the conflict then that you have between Eddington and Sisko is one that runs very deep. And it is very deep to the core of who Sisko is as a person, which is, you know, he puts a lot of faith in people and a lot of faith in his ability to read people. And what's fascinating is you get two people in his life who turn on him in that way. You get Cassidy and you get Eddington. And Cassidy has remorse about it. But of course, Eddington doesn't. And sees himself then as the hero of his own story, or the hero of the story in general. And two, again, what they're willing to do. I mean, like, the Maquis were launching biogenic weapons at Cardassian colonies.
Right.
So, I mean, they're literally terrorists at this point. So, I mean, there's a lot going into this story, which I just find it really interesting. You see this guy who's willing to make that turn, and I think that's crazy.
Yeah. And not only are they terrorists, but from the Cardassian perspective, they're acting on behalf of the Federation. And that goes back to what we were talking about earlier, that, you know, the actions can have wider repercussions, that the Federation has to rein them in because of the actions that they're taking. If they took a non-violent approach to things, then maybe the Federation would be more willing to talk to them.
Yeah, and I mean, again, I think what ends up happening is there's kind of this victimhood complex that kind of runs throughout many of those in the Maquis, and they want to see themselves as the victims of this, and pretend like there are no other choices. And I think this is one of the things where it definitely differs from the world that we live in, because they live in a galaxy with many different worlds that can be colonized. And that's just not the same when we only live on one planet, right? There's only so much space. So that's a completely different story than when there literally are hundreds of worlds that you could choose from. Right. And no, would it be the complete same? No. But are you going to keep from having an interstellar war? Yes. So maybe we should think about that.
Yeah.
And that's where I think it's interesting to watch Eddington as a character descend from somebody who seemed to be so sold out for the Federation. And what we realize is really he's only sold out for himself, because it was all about the power and the glory and all of those type of things. And that's that is an interesting story. And it makes him just another nice layer into the tapestry of Deep Space Nine.
Yeah. Well, yeah. On a show that is so driven by the characters, that makes sense that the story would revolve around him rather than around the validity of what the Maquis are doing or them as an entire group, but it's all about Eddington. And so it does work well as a character arc on the show. So just to wrap up, considering his introduction to the show, the reasons for creating the character and bringing him on, the change in direction for the character, and then how it ultimately played out, how do you feel about Eddington as part of DS9?
I think, you know, he's actually proof positive of how the writers on Deep Space Nine were so adaptive and able to create storylines, even when they're having to kind of shift mid-story. You know, obviously they do that with Eddington, they do that with Worf, they do that with the whole series. You know, there's these shifts that have to happen, and yet almost seamlessly, not completely, but almost seamlessly, they're able to work these storylines in. And I think that's just a real testament to how well these writers understood the characters and the world that they had created that they're playing in, and the way that they can stretch and move and change things, you know? And so to me, yeah, this is a character who really makes Deep Space Nine all the better for him having existed, and in many ways, maybe all the more interesting for not working out the way they thought he might at the beginning.
Yeah, that's a great point. To add to that, I think the setting of the show helps a lot in their ability to make those changes in direction, because of the nature of the station environment compared with a Federation starship they can take characters like this and put them in situations that allow them to change direction with a story or with a character in a way that makes more sense to us as a viewer. If you compare that to Voyager, for example, Seska's betrayal and move over to the Kazine worked okay because she was actually a Cardassian, right? So there was something about her that was hidden in the first place. But within that same storyline, Jonas trying to betray his crewmates didn't make any sense in the environment of the Federation starship, and what are his motives and why is he doing it? It didn't work quite as well. Whereas here, Eddington suddenly betraying his crewmates and moving over to the Maquis, it can work because there are so many things going on the station and there are so many interests other than the Federation. And it allowed the writers to have more flexibility, I think, that environment in doing something like this with the character. And then my last thoughts on the character himself is that I think that Eddington's a very interesting character. As we discussed, you kind of don't know if you should trust him or not until the point where he really just moves to the Maquis and becomes this foil for Sisko. And then that relationship between him and Sisko, I think, worked really well. He triggered something in Sisko that was not accurate for Sisko's character, but you can understand, knowing Sisko, why he took that stance towards Eddington. And I think it created some nice drama between the two characters and gave us a really interesting story. And I'm glad that the story had a resolution and that Eddington did not become a character that was just on the show all the way until the end. And somehow this conflict got resolved and he was brought back into the fold or something like that. I'm glad they didn't go down that path with him.
Yeah, I think it's actually interesting to take a character and kind of bring them down a road where they're not completely redeemed. You know, I think there's this ambiguous redemption for the character in the sense that he works to save all of these people with, you know, his own death. And yet, in some ways, you see how he brought that on himself. And so, again, it's not clear cut. And yeah. I think that's the thing that, you know, so many people praise about Deep Space Nine, and we have many a times, which is that there is this gray. It's not everything is completely black and white with Deep Space Nine, and that makes for much more interesting stories. And in the end, I think that's what makes Eddington an interesting character, because there's so much gray in that storyline. And you're not quite sure where it's going to go until you get to the very end. And in some ways, I don't think the writers were either. And that made it an exciting journey to take here as a character arc.
Yeah. Yeah, well said. And I have a question, Matthew. There's so much gray in my beard these days. Does that make me an interesting character?
I was about to say, Chris, the same thing with my own hair. So, you know, I'm right there with you. I guess we are much more interesting characters for the gray that we have.
Maybe so. There's so much gray. All right, everyone. We would love to hear your thoughts on Michael Eddington, what you think about the character, what you think about the story arc that the writers gave him. There are many ways for you to share your thoughts with us. Perhaps the best way is to go to Facebook and join the Babel Conference. That is our listeners group. If you're already a member, you know what to do. But if not, just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field, and it should come right up. If not, type the whole name, the Babel Conference. It is a closed group meant to extend the conversation beyond the podcasts. So if you're joining, please answer the questions and agree to the rules of the forum so that I can let you in. And you'll see a post for this episode on the timeline, and you can share your comments there with fellow listeners and Matthew and me. And we'd love to hear from you. If you'd like to send us email, you can do that by going to our website, trek.fm/contact. Just choose to send to a show and choose the orb, and that'll come to us by email. And lastly, you can find us in social media. We'd love to talk to you there. Our username on Instagram and Twitter and everywhere is TrekFM. If your podcast app of choice allows you to leave a rating and review, we would love to get that from you as well. Let us and others know what you think about the show. Now, Matthew, when you're not planting computer viruses aboard starships and stations to pull off your evil plan down the road, where can people find you?
Well, you know, when I'm not doing that, which I got to say does take quite a bit of time, you can find me all over the social medias under the name MattRushing02. So say Twitter, Instagram, Letterboxd, Vero, those type of places you'll find me. You'll also find me here on the network in our wonderful little hamlet called the 602 Club. It's a great place to just relax and talk about all things non-Star Trek related. So check that out here. Of course, doing literary treks about the books and the comics of Star Trek, as well as Warp 5. Chris, you and I with Star Trek Enterprise walking through the entire series with 20 years of that show now having passed. And of course, we've got Saddle Up, all about Star Trek Strange New Worlds, and The Artificial Tango, all about Star Trek Picard. And honestly, we've got a bunch of things that we've got in the works going to be coming as we talk about some other Star Trek things, which is super exciting. And then over on the Nerd Party Network, you'll find me in a completed show with Drea Kaufman talking about all chapters of the Harry Potter series, one chapter at a time, called Owlpost. And then I talk about Star Wars with John Mills on Aggressive Negotiations. But Chris, you know, if people want to see, you know, exactly how you get that really nice gray look in your beard, where can people find you?
Well, you can find me elsewhere on the network in our hair care podcast called A Shade of Gray. No, we're not doing that one yet. That's coming down the road. But yeah, you can find me elsewhere on the network on all the shows that you mentioned that you and I do together. Also, Larry Nemechek and I do The Ready Room together, and we have a new episode out, and we're talking about the state of Star Trek in 2022. We talk about all the modern series, and I'm doing air quotes there. And we have a great discussion, long discussion about Star Trek and what's happening with the franchise. So check that out. And you can find me on lots of shows in the back catalog, lots of episodes. And if you'd like to talk to me about Star Trek or Japan or whatever, college football is coming up, you could find me on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones, letter C, and Brian with a Y. That's my username everywhere in social media, but Twitter is where I'm most active, and I'd love to hear from you there. And if you would like to help us keep this show and all the shows we mentioned, everything going on the network, if you'd like to help us keep that going, we could definitely use your help. To find out how to get involved, just visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. And we'd like to thank everyone who's supporting us right now. We would definitely not be here without you. So thank you very, very much. Well, Matthew, it was great to open another orb with you. And we've got some more great topics coming up. So I'm looking forward to it.
Well, so am I, Chris. And so thank you, everyone, for joining us. And we shall see you next time as we gaze into the orb.